This is the Living Homegrown Podcast, episode number 39.
Welcome to the Living Homegrown Podcast, where it's all about how to live farm fresh without the farm. To help guide the way to a more flavorful and sustainable lifestyle is your host, national PBS TV producer and canning expert, Teresa Lowe.
Hey there, everybody, and welcome to episode number 39 of the Living Homegrown Podcast. I'm your host, Teresa Lowe, and this is where we talk about living farm fresh without the farm. And that's through artisan food crafts like canning and fermenting, growing your own very own organic food, and just living a more sustainable lifestyle. If you want to learn more about any of these topics or my online canning courses, just visit my website, livinghomegrown.com. Today's episode is about fermenting 101 with a little bit of troubleshooting thrown into the mix. You guys have been asking me a lot of questions about fermentation lately, and I think the one thing that keeps coming up is that people have a fear of fermenting because they're afraid something might go wrong. So today I have a guest I'm going to be interviewing who is really going to dive deep into all the things that can go wrong. And I think what you will see is that even when things do go wrong, it's not that bad. And no one gets sick or dies, and it's all good. So even when things go wrong, it's really not such a bad thing. Today's guest is Karen Diggs. Now, I had Karen on this podcast before. She was on one of my first episodes. She was on episode number 6. And she is the owner of the Kraut Source, which is this really cool home fermentation tool that uses an ordinary mason jar. And if you want to learn all about that, and if you want to really have a very, very basic beginner lesson on fermentation, you might want to also check out episode 6 when I had Karen on before. So that you would find that at livinghomegrown.com/06. If you do that, if you go to that episode, you can learn all about her product and how she developed it and how it's used. And we talk a little bit about the basics of fermentation and how fermentation works. Today, though, I had Karen come back to talk to us some more about fermentation because I wanted to go into some of the things that can go wrong. And if you did not hear the first episode, let me tell you a little bit about Karen. She is a certified nutritionist. She is a chef and a food writer, and she teaches culinary classes at Bowman College in Berkeley, California. And at the time that we were recording this, we both live in California. We've been in this huge drought, and today there is a really heavy, steady rain. Neither one of us were even used to this, to hearing the rain sound. And I actually don't think you can hear it on the recording. But Karen in her home is sitting right next to a window. And I know that there are some sounds that you're going to hear in the background as we were recording, but really it's nothing that distracting. But just in case you do hear rain, we are still in California. She's up near San Francisco and I'm in Los Angeles. And it was kind of an unusual thing. I kept thinking, I wonder if people can hear that, but I don't think you can. Now, as you're listening to this episode, Karen's going to be talking about a recipe, or she may mention ratios, or she might even give a resource as we're talking. And I don't want you to worry about writing any of that down. Just remember that, as always, all the resources for anything mentioned will be in the show notes for this episode. I have also put together a free getting started guide on fermenting 101. I just thought it would be really helpful to you to have a resource guide that's a PDF that you could either download or print out, and it'll just help you get started. So after you listen to this episode, you can get that as well, and it includes links and recommended books, and I'm also going to include resources for fermentation supplies. And you can get everything by going to livinghomegrown.com/39. So just go there and everything will be there for you. So instead of trying to write anything down, just sit back and relax and listen and enjoy this interview that I have with Karen Diggs of Kraut Source. Hey, Karen, thanks so much for joining me today.
Teresa, it's a pleasure to be back, and thank you for inviting me again.
Sure. I think this is going to be a really fun topic. I know a lot of my listeners are really interested in fermenting, and when you were on the show before for episode 6, it got a big response. And in that episode, we just kind of talked about why you would want to ferment and kind of the basics of how fermenting works. And then we talked about your kraut source, which I would love to have you explain again right now. What is the kraut source?
Okay, so kraut source is a what I call a nifty device that sits on a mason jar. And it enables people to make a small batch of fermented vegetables such as sauerkraut or pickles at home. And it serves all the basic purpose or the necessary items that you need to make a good fermentation. So it's made of stainless steel, so it doesn't react with brine or salt. It has a little press so that it keeps everything submerged. And it has a moat, which you fill with water and then cap it, so it keeps everything airtight. So those are the important things, keeping your vegetables submerged beneath the brine, and then also keeping air out while it's being fermented.
Yes, it's kind of like a little miniature version of some of those larger crocks, and it looks so cute in the little mason jar, and you can put it on any of any different size mason jar, so it's a really nifty tool, and I'm so glad you invented it, because I love how it looks.
Thank you.
It just looks cute on the countertop.
Thank you. I like to think of the fermentation as being, you know, art. We're creating edible art, and so, you know, kraut source, I think, sort of makes it look pretty on your kitchen counter, like you said.
I love that. Yes, we are making art. I think so many of the different things that we make from hand, you know, we're putting a little bit of love into every batch. So it's kind of cool.
Absolutely.
Now, last time when you were here, right at the very end of the episode, you mentioned that you were working on a book. And now you have that book coming out this month. Isn't that right?
Yes, I do. So the official launch date is January 30th. I actually have a book signing at Barnes & Noble in Emeryville, California. And I'm just really, well, I'm happy. The title is called Happy Foods. So they are recipes, all of them gluten-free, that helps to elevate mood and keep you basically happy and healthy. And I have, I think, one sauerkraut recipe in there, but I definitely talk about the importance of having lacto-fermented vegetables in your diet with the good probiotics, and that is really great for digestion.
Well, congratulations. I'm so excited for you, because I know before you were working on this, and it's a big job to bring out a book into the world. So that's really great.
Thank you.
Now, while you're on the topic here of the benefits, and I know we covered this all in episode 6, but could you just real briefly explain to people, why do we even want to do this fermentation thing?
Okay. All right. Well, we want to do it, first of all, because it's fun.
Yes.
And it's fun. And like I said, it's edible art. But beyond that, you know, it's something that our ancestors, it doesn't matter what culture you come from, our ancestors collectively have all fermented foods of some type. And now modern science is validating the fact that we need different strains of good bacteria in our gut to help us digest, to stimulate our immune system, and to actually break apart food so that we can readily assimilate the nutrients from those foods. So, you know, digestion, energy, stimulation of the immune system, all of these are really great health benefits, and it's very basic. You know, getting some vegetables like cabbage, adding salt, adding some water, and allowing time to do its magic. And by doing so, the good bacteria will naturally thrive. And when we eat it, they become a part of our what is known as the microbiome. And I like to think of it as, you know, our digestive system is sort of like the soil of who we are. And if we can internally have a good microbiome, then I think in the long run, it'll benefit the exterior, which is the outer soil, the earth that we know. So what's good for us internally will also in time be good for our environment.
You know, I definitely noticed a difference in my immune system after I started eating fermented foods. I used to catch every single cold that and my kids too at right. would go to school and bring, you know, God knows what.
Yes.
And we would all catch every single bug. As we started incorporating more fermented foods into our diet, it just kept getting less and less illnesses. And right. now, even if we catch something, mm-hmm. it's very rare that it knocks us down. You know, right. it's right. A more mild version of what all my friends might be having. And we kind of get over everything a lot faster. So I was surprised because I really started fermenting for the fun of it because I'm, you know, kind of nutty that way. I like it's a, you know, crazy science project to me.
Yes.
But also for the flavor. Yeah. And I started with pickles. And then as I got more and more into my diet, I definitely noticed the health benefits.
Yeah. And I think, you know, sometimes it can be very subtle for some people. It's sort of, you have to start eating it regularly over a period of time. And maybe in a month or two, you suddenly realize, wow, you know, I don't have allergies as bad as the last season, or I haven't caught a cold, you know, and it's in the dead of winter. So that's the nice thing about fermented foods, because you're doing it in your own kitchen and you're just sort of doing it as something that you do every day, then it becomes really incorporated into your life. And so everybody benefits when you're doing it for yourself and for your family.
Yeah, there's kind of a rhythm to it.
Yes, absolutely. And then, you know, seasonal too, because you can ferment all kinds of things that come into season.
Yeah, that was actually really why I wanted to bring you back here for a winter episode, because mm-hmm. most people think of fermenting, just like they think of canning, as only being a summer or spring or fall type of activity. But
right.
you can ferment all year long. In fact, fermenting in the wintertime is kind of a fun way to keep things going, you know, mm-hmm. that keep preservation projects going in your kitchen. So the thing that usually happens, though, if someone has never done this before, is it kind of seems a little out of our comfort zone. Like when you think about it, it can freak people out. Like when I try to explain, okay, you know, you take your vegetables and you mix some water and a little bit of salt and you put it in a jar and set it on the counter, they're thinking, oh my gosh, I will die of botulism or something.
Right,
so
right.
the thing that we really went into deep in episode 6 was, you know, kind of how it works. But I wanted to today kind of push people along a little bit further and let them know how it works and some of the things that can go wrong. So that's mm-hmm. what we're going to talk about today, is some of the troubleshooting that happens. Because what I find with fermenting is that even when things go wrong, it's not that bad, you know?
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Like no one's going to die.
And rarely do people even get sick. I mean, you might have a little bit of a tummy ache, but yeah. things would be fine, you know?
Yeah. Things might move through a little quicker, we could say.
Right.
Yeah. But that rarely happens. And I think that's when you eat fermented foods all the time, it's more that usually happens with someone who has never had any fermented food, and then they consume a whole lot right off the bat, and their body kind of reacts to that shock.
Your ecosystem is just suddenly different, you know? So by introducing a lot of probiotics or good bacteria, you know, sort of like a war wages in your tummy. And then so you could get a little bit of growling and gas, but it will subside over time if you continue to eat the fermented foods regularly, in a small measured amount,
mm-hmm.
Then, you know, everything would just sort of right itself. And that's really the beauty of getting our nutrients through foods rather than taking supplements.
Do you usually recommend to people that they start out slowly?
I do. I would say, you know, with every meal, about a third of a cup to start.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then you can definitely build it up. But, you know, it is, fermented foods should be considered a condiment and not, you know, the main dish. So whenever you think about that, just remember it's a condiment, it's an accessory to other items that you're eating.
That's a good tip. Okay.
Yeah, but like, I mean, this is probably more appropriate to women, but, you know, like an accessory, like a beautiful accessory, you want to wear it all the time. So
yeah.
fermented foods, you know, it's an accessory, but you want to have it. You want to eat it with each meal.
That's a great way to look at it. Yes. Yeah, I like that. Okay, yeah. So let's dive in, and I'd love for you to explain to everybody a basic ferment. So we're talking through this whole episode, Karen and I talked ahead of time, and she has this great recipe. She's going to walk everybody through this basic recipe from start to finish so we can kind of talk about how everything works. And then we'll also talk about how things can go wrong. And sure. Why don't you explain about a brine and what we're going to be doing?
Okay, so first of all, when you are making fermented either vegetables or fruit, it's really important to have salt, and the quality of the salt is important. So I use almost exclusively Celtic sea salt, but you can use any good quality sea salt or mineral salt as well. Just don't use regular table salt, because that really has all the nutrients stripped away, and it also has caking agents in it, which are not helpful. So basically, a brine is a ratio of salt to water. And, you know, there are many ratios that you can look at, but I just like to keep things simple. So I usually just tell people who start 1 level teaspoon of salt to 1 cup of water. So that's a ratio that you can pretty much go by and it won't fail you.
Yeah. And the thing that people can understand also is that you can adjust that a little bit. Like, you can add, yes, a little bit more. For me, my basic ratio that I usually go with is 1.5 teaspoons to one,
right,
cup,
right,
which I think is more of like a 5%.
Right.
And I think yours is more like 4.5%.
Yeah.
But it, and some people even like to go saltier, but I don't like to have that much salt.
Yeah.
So
it also depends on the ingredients that you're using too, you know, to, mm-hmm, whether you want it a little saltier or less.
Right. Okay. So 1 teaspoon of salt, a level teaspoon of salt, and 1 cup of water. And explain about the water.
Okay. So water quality is also important. If you're living in an area where the municipal water has either chloride or chloramine or fluoride added into it, it's a good idea, if you can, you know, filter those chemicals out. Sometimes they're tricky. Chloramine is very hard to get rid of, as is fluoride. So you do the best you can. And if you're somewhere where there's just no filtration available, at least boil the water for, you know, a minute, a good rolling boil, and then let the water cool off. And then you can use that water with the salt.
Yes, that's good. So yeah, we don't want to make anyone feel like if you don't have filtered water that you can't do it, because you...
No, yeah.
Yeah, because I've used bottled water and I've used my tap water, and sometimes the ferment might go a little slower, maybe, because of some of the things that are in there. But if you don't have any choice, then use what you got and give it a shot. And,
right, exactly.
Yeah, that's great. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We're leading up to making this ferment. So there,
sure,
we've got,
yeah,
this brine. And so what's the recipe that you're going to be telling,
okay,
everybody about?
Okay. So this is one of my, you know, new favorite recipes. One, because we talked about seasonality. So the title of the recipe is raw cranberry apple chutney.
Yum.
And so, yeah. So, you know, we're winter here, at least in California. So, you know, there are all kinds of beautiful apples that are available. Cranberries are still available, as you mentioned. And if you don't have fresh cranberries, you can also use raw cranberries. You know, just thaw them out.
Yeah. So you can use frozen. You mean frozen?
Yeah. Yeah. I meant frozen. Sorry.
Yeah. That's okay. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah. So we can use frozen. And I have not done this one myself, but I'm totally going to do it. And I saw some of your pictures on your website, and it's beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
I just have to stop you and ask, what made you think of putting this together? Because I wouldn't have thought to do this, to do a fruit with cranberry and apple.
Yeah, you know, the thing about it is, you know, I thought about this, you know, well before Thanksgiving. And, you know, my favorite thing is to cook a heritage turkey on Thanksgiving. What I don't like is that we tend to just always do a relish that's super sweet, because the cranberry is so tart, and then we just add in a ton of sugar.
Yeah.
And then basically it's like putting a jam on a piece of meat. You know?
Yes.
So,
well, that's really what it is. Yes.
Yeah. So then I thought, you know, let's try something different. So because I'm so into fermentation, and I like that the taste of like kind of sour, sweet, but also spicy. And I feel that that really goes well with game or poultry. So then, you know, I took a green apple, the fresh cranberries, and I always like a little bit of onion in my ferment. That's just my personal preference. So I added in purple onions for the color. And then spices. Being this time of year, we want warming spices. So I added in cinnamon, a star anise, and ginger, and fermented it on the counter for about 5 to 6 days. And it just turned out to be this beautiful chutney. And the bonus is the brine had this lovely sort of perky, sweet, tangy flavor. And when I mix it with rum, it makes an awesome cocktail. Actually, rum and cranberry juice.
Oh my gosh.
Sweetened with a little bit of, I think it was maple syrup that I added. So the bonus was, you have the first thing, you have the chutney that's, you know, raw, fermented, has all the goodness of, you know, the raw nutrients being there, plus the probiotics from fermentation, and the flavor that pairs really well with things that we eat around the holidays. And then the brine, you know, you make what I call a cultured cocktail. So I like to think of it as being much healthier than a regular cocktail. That's up for debate.
Yeah, no, I think it is. I mean, it has to be, right? But this is awesome. So you're using every part of your fermentation.
Absolutely.
And so you're going from start to finish. You create something that's delicious and is good for you. And then you can use the brine to make a cocktail at the end at the end of the day. That is really, really cool. Okay, I'm excited to do this. So tell us what we do, how we make this. How do we make this stuff?
Okay, so you gather all the ingredients. You know, so the cranberries are just, they'll be kept whole. So there's nothing that you need to do with those. The apple, I would dice it into small cubes, you know, maybe around the size of a little larger than a green pea. It just depends on your own personal preference. So, you know, around that size.
And we leave the skin on?
You leave the skin on if it's organic, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I used a green apple. I think it was a pippin apple, just for the color. But you can use any apple that you want. Just make sure it's nice and firm and not, you know, not mushy.
Okay.
And then you can use purple onion, regular onion, or you can even use shallots. So again, you would dice that to about the same size as you would the apple dices.
Okay.
And then you can add in spices. For my recipe, I used cinnamon stick, one star anise, and some grated ginger.
Okay, and I should say now that if anyone's like driving in their car thinking, oh my gosh, they have to pull over and write this all down, I'm going to have information in the show notes for this episode, and it's going to have information all about Karen and the Kraut Source and a link to this recipe that she has on her website. So you don't have to write anything down. Just remember, the show notes are at livinghomegrown.com/39. And when you go there, you'll have everything. So you have access to get everything from Karen. So go ahead, Karen. I'm sorry to interrupt. I was thinking as you were saying all of this, someone's going, oh man, okay, where's a pen?
Well, thank you for making it so accessible. So anyway, you have your spices and you have your ingredients. And then you would just toss it in a bowl and sort of mix it well together. And then put it into a mason jar.
Okay. And just for reference, could you tell us how many cranberries and how many green apples? I know it depends on what size jar you're using. If you could just run off what it was for the recipe that's on your website, just so people have an idea in their head. I know they'll go and just get the recipe from your website.
Got it. So the recipe that I have posted is actually for a pint-sized mason jar.
Okay.
And so in terms of cranberries, about a third cup. And then two small apples, and then, you know, a third cup of chopped onions. So that's kind of like the proportion that we're looking at.
Okay, great. And then just one cinnamon stick?
One or two cinnamon stick.
Okay.
And then the amount of salt here for this recipe, I actually had 1.5 teaspoons to 2 cups of water.
Got it. Okay.
I didn't want to make it too salty because of the apples.
Sure.
So that's basically, you know, the ingredients. And then you put it into the mason jar. And then if you're using a Kraut Source, and you would, you know, secure that on. If not, then you can rig up your own system. But again, the crucial point is to keep all of the ingredients submerged underneath the brine. And then figure out some way to keep it anaerobic, so no oxygen going in.
Okay, and I'll link to the kraut source in the show notes and some other information which we had in the first episode that you did with us, episode 6. I'll also link to that so people can get all that kind of information on any kind of tools that they might need for their container.
Right.
One thing, when they're mixing up the salt, just so that they understand, they don't have to cook the water and dissolve the salt, right? They are just adding the salt and the water and stirring it. I want to make sure people don't think.
Right, right. You don't have to go through great lengths to do that. You know, if you don't want to heat up the water, just make sure that the salt mm-hmm. is dissolved in the water, and then you can just, you know, top off. Once you have the ingredients packed into the jar.
Okay, so we pack the ingredients into the jar, and then we have mixed up some brine, and we just pour that so that there's enough to cover so that all the ingredients can be submerged. Now,
right.
If they don't have a kraut source, mm-hmm. there are other ways that people can push down the food inside the bigger jar.
Right, yeah. So the most common one is what I call the jar-in-jar method.
Yeah, that's okay, what so, I use. Yes, that's what I do too. Before I had a kraut source, that's how I did it.
So you can get the smallest mason jar that's available, and usually the small ones will fit through the diameter of a Y-mouth mason jar. So, you know, you can just put the small jar into that, you know, push everything down. And sometimes you might need to add in some weight into that small jar. So put in some pebbles or sand or whatever so that it carries weight. And then you just sort of put that on top of the ingredients. And then you can just cover everything with a very fine cheesecloth and secure it with a piece of string.
Yeah. Now, the way I would do is I would take like a half pint jelly jar mm-hmm. and I would put water in it. And that kind of weighs it down.
Sure,
and I would put the lid on it so that the water wouldn't, I didn't want the water to jostle into my ferment, and I would set that inside the larger jar and push everything down so that holds all the food below the brine. And that's just important because if the food's above the brine, it can go bad. And then I would take a cheesecloth or a tea towel, and I used a rubber band to hold it over mm-hmm. everything. And the main reason for that is to make sure that nothing falls into your brine and to keep the bugs out. And
absolutely,
because some things have quite an odor when they're fermenting, like sauerkraut, and you kind of attract things. You don't want any little critters going down in there. They'll fall. More protein, I guess. But
more protein. But sometimes it can make your ferments go bad. So you want to keep those things from vacationing on your ferment. Yeah.
Exactly. Good point. Okay. So we have everything mixed up, and we've put in our brine, and we have everything submerged, and we have it either we've attached our kraut source or whatever we need to do so that we have it covered up. Mm-hmm. What do we do next?
Okay, then I would place it at a place on your kitchen counter that's, you know, the coolest spot if possible, and then away from direct sunlight, because if, you know, the afternoon or morning sun hits it, it's not ideal for fermentation. So a nice, cool, shady spot.
Okay, and this is the part where people start to get nervous, mm-hmm. especially when we're doing vegetables, you know.
Right.
But the thing that is happening inside that jar is that there's wild bacteria. We're not mm-hmm. adding any culture. We're doing our own culture or wild ferment. And there's all kinds of bacteria that is on the food and in the air, and it will start to create a lactic acid environment. And the reason we have salt, just as an FYI, if people don't know this, the reason we have salt is that inhibits the bad bacteria. And mm-hmm. the good bacteria that creates the lactic acid loves the salt to that ratio that we have, you know, the 4% to 6% ratio. So they get all excited and they start going to town, and the bad bacteria, even if it's in there, doesn't mm-hmm. do anything. Mm-hmm. And that's why you can set it at room temperature on your counter and be perfectly safe.
Yeah, fantastic, Teresa. That's a really great explanation of what happens. You know, different strains of good bacteria will come into play when it's given the right environment. And then one more thing that actually does help the lactic acid sort of jumpstart to produce all these different strains is that you're keeping it oxygen-free. So the combination of the salt and the lack of oxygen, that's what these good bacteria love to thrive in.
Right. Okay. Good point. Right. And that's why we have it submerged. So all those foods are under the water. So they're not sitting out getting oxygen. All right. So what happens next?
Okay. What happens next is time, patience. Okay. And so I always tell people a minimum of 5 to 6 days, because it does take that long for those strains of bacteria to come into proliferation, you know, the good ones that we just talked about. So give it, you know, a few days, 5 to 6 days. Now, there is a little tricky part when you're doing fruit. So the recipe that we've talked about is primarily fruit. You know, there's a onion in there. So with fruit, you do want to be careful, because if you're allowing it to ferment for too long on the kitchen counter, it can tilt beyond fermentation into alcohol.
Ah.
In which case, it probably will still taste good, but the probiotics will probably start to die away very quickly. So for this particular recipe that we've been talking about, I would say about 5 to 6 days. Mm-hmm. But if you're doing, you know, a mainly vegetable-based fermentation, such as traditional sauerkraut or pickles, or if you're using cauliflower and other vegetables, then the fermentation can go longer, anywhere from 7 days to 2 weeks.
Perfect. Okay. And how, the other question I know people always ask me is, how do they know when it's done?
Okay. Well, you know, that's kind of like a subjective thing too. And I would have to say, the thing about making your own fermented foods is you might taste it one day and you're thinking, wow, this is perfect. I love it. So you stop the fermentation and then you move it to the refrigerator to store. So, you know, we're fermenting at room temperature, and when we think it's ready, we store it in the refrigerator. However, the fermentation actually never stops. It just goes very, very slowly once it's inside your refrigerator. So what I find fascinating is that I might taste something and think, oh, this is great. I put it in the refrigerator and I forget about it for, let's say, 7 or 10 days. I go back and taste it again, and most often than not, the flavor has actually improved.
Ah, right.
Yeah, the flavor changes all the time. So that's why I say it's very subjective. But to make things simple, let's say you ferment something and at 5 or 6 days you taste it and it's like, oh, it has a nice crunch, but you can definitely smell the pleasant sourness of the fermentation. And you're like, okay, if it smells ready to you and if it's tasting good to you, then it's ready.
Perfect. Yes, I agree. And there's really no right or wrong answer. And sometimes you might do something and then the next time maybe let it go a little longer and see, you know,
exactly.
It might be different.
Yeah. You know, and I recommend at least 5-6 days for the probiotics to develop. But, you know, sometimes you might start something at day 3, for instance, you need to leave town for a week, which does happen. Mm-hmm. What you can do then is move it to the refrigerator and just let it ferment, you know, longer. So instead of, you know, the usual 7 to 10 days, when you come back from your vacation, you know, take a note that it's still in your refrigerator and let it sit there for maybe another 2 to 3 weeks.
Good. Yes. And you might be surprised what you get when you come back.
Yeah. So that's why, you know, as you mentioned before, you like it. You like to ferment because you're like kind of crazy and you're just like, me too. Yeah. I think fermentation brings out that part of us, the artistic, crazy, let's just see what happens when we ferment side of us. So I encourage this, you know, for all your listeners.
Yeah. And, you know, anyone who knows me knows that I'm a very, buttoned up gal. And I, this is one place where I like to let loose a little I normally am a very, you know, okay, like I'm down timing it with a timer type of person. But with fermenting, it's very kind of loosey goosey. And that is actually makes it easier. You know, you don't have to go, oh my gosh, it's been an extra day. Now my ferment is ruined. No, not at all. It's still okay. Yeah. So you can relax a little bit with this, which is nice. That's why it's a good project. And we're talking about small batch fermentation. So you're not losing a lot of, you know, you could make something and decide you didn't like it. And so then maybe you end up giving it to the chickens or composting it. And it's not the end of the world, because we're only talking, you know, a little jar that was sitting on the counter, not 20 pounds of something, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're not like our ancestors where we had to preserve that vegetable, because if we don't have anything else to rely on.
Right. Yeah. No, this is more for fun and for health.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, so, okay. So then after that amount of time, we put it into the refrigerator and then we'll be able to consume it when we want to. Now, before we go into what happens next, I'd love to talk just a little bit about some of the things that can go wrong with fermenting, because that's always everyone's biggest fear. Like, well, but what if something goes wrong? So what are some of the common things that can happen?
Right. Well, we talked about the fun part. So definitely when you see things that are strangely colored or that has an off smell, that is also fun.
So don't panic. That's the main thing. Don't panic. Yeah.
Have fun. The most common one, we'll just start with the most common and the most harmless one, is what we call... it's like a little thin layer of film or white that can start to develop on the very top of your ferment. And it's called calm, K-A-H-M. So when you see calm, just keep calm. I just came up with that. That was terrible.
I think that's really cute. I'm totally leaving that in. Okay. I love that.
It's very harmless. It's just like a very thin layer of, like I said, a very benign yeast. And you can just kind of pour that off or skim it off. No problem there.
Yeah. So you could just take a spoon and skim it out. Yeah. Okay. And everything underneath is still good because it's from the yeast, right?
Right. Yeah. And sometimes what I'll do is, you know, after I've skimmed off or pour off the calm, I might just sprinkle a little bit more salt over the top to make sure that, you know, it doesn't happen again.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's very benign. But then moving on to more... serious stuff. Again, another white film can develop, but if you look at it, it's very different from the calm. It sort of has a structure to it, and there might be little fuzzy things that sort of shoot out from the initial layer. I'm not a microbiologist, so I couldn't tell you specifically what it is, and it could be different things. That usually happens when too much air has been allowed to go in. So it's either you're checking it too often, or you know, the cheesecloth that you're using just is too porous, or the water level dropped, you know, too low. So if it's something that's kind of white and fuzzy, again, me, I would just skim it off and I would look at what's underneath. And if it looks like everything is fine, if it smells good, then I would just continue with my fermentation. But if you are just too squirmy to deal with that, or you have a challenged immune system, then throw it out, you know. Give it to the compost.
Right. Because again, we're not talking about a lot. And I think also, isn't there usually a smell?
There's a smell, right.
Yeah. So it smells off.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, trust your nose, because I think biologically we know when something really smells putrid, you know, so if anything smells putrid, out.
Yes. Yeah. That's kind of my rule of thumb. If it smells like something you don't want to taste, then don't taste it.
Smells a hard thing to describe. So I've described it to someone as the difference between yogurt and milk that's gone bad. You know, we all know milk that's gone bad. It's kind of like you're repulsed by it. You know, but yogurt, you know, it's soured. It is naturally soured and it's not spoiled. So that might be a good guideline for some people. So if you're smelling your fermented vegetables or fruit and it smells sour, but it doesn't make you, you know, recoil, then it's probably good.
Yes. And there's certain foods that have a stronger odor.
Right.
So, you know, like if you're doing, I don't know, it's like Brussels sprouts, for example,
that
you're going to get an odor with that, you know, smells like Brussels sprouts. But
right, very sulfuric. Yeah.
Yes, yes. But when something goes bad, I mean, I just know it. You stick your nose in there and you go, ugh.
Yeah, exactly.
And that, I mean, right there, it's like I couldn't pay my kids to eat it. So we've talked about the kind of white thing that we get, and now we've talked about with the more of the white mold that has more of a structure. What are some other things that can go wrong?
Other things could be that we talked about the brine, and you know, you can use it for cocktails and so forth, but you know, sometimes the brine can become kind of a little slimy, in which case it's actually not harmful. And it can be several things: that the fermentation happened in too warm of an environment. And so sometimes it can cause it to become a little bit slimy, or sometimes it could be that you didn't use enough salt. So slime has actually different genesis of why it would become slimy. But usually I find that the slime, other than it just looks a little slimy, it's okay. And for people who don't like that, I would just tell them, you know, you can give the fermented vegetables just a very quick rinse to get rid of that slime, or you can just pour it off and eat the vegetables. So it's not harmful.
Okay. And since we're talking about slime, what about mushy vegetables?
Yeah. So mushy vegetable is also not harmful, although not pleasant. Some of your listeners might know who Sandor Katz is. You know, we both know him as he is the god of fermentation.
Yes. Yes,
but
absolutely.
I remember being in a talk where he said that he traveled to some place in Eastern Europe where the norm was to have sauerkraut that's very mushy. And for them, if it's not mushy, it wasn't really sauerkraut.
Wow.
So it's a matter of taste preference.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so if anyone is ever doing a vegetable ferment and their vegetables get mushy, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean that they've gone bad. If they still smell fine
smell, if it smells fine, if it tastes a little bit mushy, but the flavors are still there, then it's okay.
Yeah. You still have to go with your nose and your mm-hmm. taste buds. I mean, if something tastes putrid, then of course you don't want to eat it. But definitely, yeah. So that's good. Okay. And another thing, while I'm thinking of it, a lot of people talk about the sediment that gets to the bottom of their jar, and that kind of scares them. With a lot of ferments, you'll get sediment at the bottom. So explain what that is.
Yeah. So I find that particularly when you make pickles from cucumbers, you know, after a time, you would get the sediment on the bottom of the jar. So in the process of fermentation, you know, we know that there's lactic acid. And the lactic acid creates carbon dioxide, CO2. And as a byproduct of all this activity, there are different microorganisms that are produced. And some of them have a yeast-like quality, and other have sort of like a fungi-like quality. But nonetheless, whatever residues are produced during the fermentation, those are actually just as a byproduct of fermentation. And sometimes over time, they'll settle to the bottom. And so that's what we're looking at. You know, it's just sedimentation of the natural process. And it's nothing to worry about. And sometimes if you, for instance, with pickles, I know that when I've left it on the counter for, let's say, 10, 12 days, I'll see some sediment. And then once I put it into the refrigerator and leave it there for maybe another week or so, the brine then becomes, again, very clear, so you don't have sort of a murky brine. And then all the sedimentation has gone down to the bottom.
Yes, it kind of settles, yes.
Settles, yeah. Mm-hmm. So the sediment is really nothing to worry about.
And you mentioned the cloudy. Getting cloudiness in your mm-hmm. ferment is okay as well, correct?
Yeah, it's quite fine as well. Again, it is part of the process of fermentation. And it could also be the type of salt that you're using, and also the water. You know, some water might have more mineral content than others, depending on the source. And the minerals might sometimes contribute to a cloudier brine.
Good. Okay. And one other thing that people sometimes see, and it scares them, but this is completely normal, and that's to see bubbles. You might see bubbles, and that's what you... Bubbles are good.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. And usually that happens at the beginning stages. So I think usually like 2-3 days into the ferment, you'll see, you know, bubbles on top. And that's what you want to see, because it's the CO2, you know, in action.
Yes. And all of these things, you guys will have noticed that we never mentioned botulism. And that's because when you are doing a ferment, everything, the liquid, is being turned into lactic acid, which has a pH level where botulism is not an issue at all. And so that means that fermentation is really a very safe process, and it's nothing to be afraid of. So in all of these cases, the worst thing that happens is that the food goes bad, and that, just like something would go bad in your refrigerator. But not that someone is going to be killed by eating what you're creating. So that, I think, if everybody understands that, it kind of takes that fear away that, you know, we're just talking about doing something where, yes, you know, something could go wrong and the food might go bad or go rancid, really. But that's the worst case scenario. And you will know it very clearly. You will know it, just like you know it when you pull milk out of the refrigerator and it's gone bad.
Right. And then the other thing about, you know, your fermented product, in order to enjoy the health benefits of the probiotic, you don't really want to heat it up beyond 113 degrees Fahrenheit. So, and I do get this question. People will ask me, well, how do I preserve it after it's done? You keep it in the refrigerator. What you do not want to do is you don't want to, you know, can it. Because no. Then it's sort of like you're, that's against the whole purpose of live culture fermentation.
Right. Although when you make a pickle, people think that, okay, now I fermented the pickle. Now I want to can it for the shelf. And you certainly could do that, but
yeah,
the main point of fermenting the pickle was to get the probiotic benefits, and you end up killing it when you put that everything in the water bath canner and heating it up.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
You want to just store it in your refrigerator and consume it. And that's why small batches are so great.
Mm-hmm. Because you go through it quickly and then you get inspired to do another batch, and you know, it just, that's why what I mentioned in the beginning, it sort of becomes a routine in your life where you're just always making, you know, a batch, and then you never run out, hopefully.
Yeah. And also the thing to remember is that fermentation is a form of preservation. So you're extending what would be the shelf life of this food, but you don't have to extend it for a year like you would a jar on the shelf.
No, yeah. And that's the other thing too. When people ask me, like, how long would it last in the refrigerator? So I said, well, theoretically, it could last for, you know, months, even years. But the whole point of making that is that you're eating it every day. So it should not be in your refrigerator for months. You
right.
know? Perhaps a couple of weeks, you know, to a month max.
Sure. And yes, you can totally can up for the pantry. You can can your pickles, but just know if you ever do that with a fermented pickle, you are basically eliminating the probiotic element.
Right.
But
right.
if you needed it, you know, so that you had it, I don't know, in case of an earthquake, you know,
right.
if you're prepping and you wanted to make sure you did have it, you could certainly do that. It won't make it inedible, but it eliminates that health benefit, which is a really great reason to want to do fermentation.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, because you're taking a healthy vegetable or a healthy fruit and making it even more healthy.
Yeah, you're amplifying the nutrients, which is just, it's so amazing, you know, really amazing.
Great. Okay, so we've kind of talked about all the things that can go wrong. And I think we've kind of eliminated that fear, which is great. Mm-hmm. Thank you for doing that, because I know those are the questions that I get. You touched on all of them. That's fantastic.
Right. Yeah. I hope this would definitely allay a lot of the fears that people have as an obstacle to starting. But I would say, you know, once you start, the more that you make, the more you're comfortable with it. And, you know, over, I think, a course of a few batches, I think most people become very comfortable with it, and they start branching out. They start like using all kinds of herbs and spices and, you know, fun ingredients. So once you get comfortable, then the fun starts.
Yeah. You know, like I said, I'm a real buttoned up gal, and you and I were talking one time and you were joking about how some people get really uptight about measuring and making sure that they have like the exact perfect ratio. Well, that was me when I first started. I was totally that girl. But like you said, you get a few ferments in under your belt and then you're like, okay, I can relax a little bit. I can see how this works, you know, and when you understand the science of what's happening so that you're not afraid of it, then it's not so scary. But back to the recipe that we started with.
Yes.
So we've gone through everything in the world that could possibly ever go wrong. And we've had it. We have it in the refrigerator. And let's say we've eaten up all of that relish.
Mm-hmm.
How do we make a cocktail with it? Because I'm dying to know.
Okay. So the cocktail recipe is also on my website, but I'm just pulling it up right now as we speak. So with the cocktail, we're using about 1 ounce of the brine and equal part of rum. In my own particular recipe, I used a really nice handcrafted artisanal rum that's from Northern California. And then I added in 2 ounces of cranberry juice, 1 tablespoon of maple syrup, and a little squeeze of fresh lime. You pour that into a shaker with some ice, give it a good, you know, my bartender friends tell me you're supposed to shake it at least 30 times.
Wow, so, okay.
Yeah. So shake it 30 times and then strain it, pour it into a nice cocktail glass, and there you have it.
Well, I was looking at the photo that you had of this. It looks amazing. It is so beautiful with that bright red color.
Yeah, it's very, very festive. And, you know, as we mentioned before, I'd like to think that because there are some probiotics still riding on this cocktail, that it may be a little bit healthier than just... a non-cultured cocktail.
Well, more than anything, though, also, and I'm sure it is, but I think also it's nice to be able to use up that brine. And I think you, don't you have recipes on your website also of things we can do with the brine, like making salad dressings and things like
that? Right, yeah, you can use it to make salad dressings. I've also used the brine, I think it was from pickles, to make a homemade mayonnaise.
Great.
And yeah, and something else that I've discovered too, if you are a meat eater, the brine can be used to literally like brine a piece of chicken or a steak. You know, you would throw away the brine, of course, afterwards and cook the piece of meat. But that brine, because of this acidity, is acting very much like a vinegar or a wine. And so it will actually help to tenderize the protein as well as flavor it.
Right as you said that, my jaw dropped. I don't know why I never thought of that.
Yeah.
That is such a great idea.
I did some turkey breast in the pickle brine, and I let it sit there for a good 48 hours before I pat it dry and I roasted it. And it tasted mildly of pickles. It was really nice. It was, you do have to add in a little bit more salt and seasoning to the meat when you're cooking it, but it retained a little bit of that nice pickle flavor.
That is fabulous idea. I'm going to totally do that. And the thing with brining, if anyone doesn't know, is when you brine, it draws moisture into the meat. Mm-hmm. So that salty water forces the meat to absorb more liquid. And so it ends up giving you a really tender, juicy cooked meat. So if you're a meat eater, brining is kind of a fun thing to do. And I've done it with, adding herbs to the brine and things like that.
Right.
But it never even occurred to me to use my ferment brine. What a fabulous idea. Okay, I'm totally doing that too.
Okay. So for your vegan listeners, if they're using tempeh, with tempeh, you need to steam it first. But after steaming, you could also marinate it in a brine for the flavor.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, I'll do all of these things and then I'll report back to you.
Okay. I would love to hear it. I personally love it. I mean, I thought, oh my God, this is so good.
Yeah, it is. It's just fantastic. Well, I love how creative you are. And I love that you're experimenting. And now I'm going to call all of my ferments art because I got that from you. So I think that's really fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Karen. This has been a great episode. I think we dived into a lot of information and dispelled a lot of the fears. And I hope everybody who's listening will give it a shot. And just as a reminder, I'm going to have all this information in the show notes for this episode. And that'll be at livinghomegrown.com/39. And I'll link to everything for you, Karen. So thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Teresa. It's been really, really a pleasure. And thank you so much for inviting me.
I'm totally going to go run off now and get some cranberries so I can make this.
Okay, well, cheers.
Okay, so that was my interview with Karen. It was packed with information. I hope you got a lot out of that. I think it will really help anyone that wants to get started in fermentation. This is a great place to start with any food preservation. So I'm going to have everything that was mentioned, including information on her tool, the Krautsource, which you can get at her website, and her book that is coming out right after this episode airs. I will have a link in the show notes to where you can order the book or learn more about it. So to get all of that, just go to livinghomegrown.com/39. And I hope that you're going to be like me and run out and get some cranberries and some apples and dive into this recipe. I think it will be fun. Until next time, keep working towards living just a little bit more local, seasonal, and homegrown. And I'll see you next week. Take care.
That's all for this episode of the Living Homegrown Podcast. Visit livinghomegrown.com to download Teresa's free canning resource guide and find more tips on how to live farm fresh without the farm. Be sure to join Teresa Lowe next time on the Living Homegrown Podcast.
Yeah, well, we didn't start getting rain until just this morning. So,
okay.
Yeah, maybe like 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning. And it's funny, the chickens are looking up at the sky like, what is that stuff coming down? It's been so long. They have no idea what it is. And
funny.
I know. And the dog too. The dog's like, I'm not going out in that. I don't know.
you never run out, hopefully.
Yeah. And so, okay, hold on. I lost my train of thought. Hold on. Let me see. What was I going to say?
Okay.
Let me think. Okay. Yes. Also,